From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dr. Donald Berwick stepped down Thursday as chief of America's Medicare and Medicaid programs, the sprawling giants that cover health care for one in every three Americans. President Obama put him in that job with a controversial recess appointment in July 2010. Berwick would have loved to stay to cut costs and improve care, he says, and to champion Obama's health care reforms. But Senate Republicans were having none of it. He's out and here with us. This hour on Point, Dr. Berwick goes to Washington, hits the buzzsaw, and comes back home to talk about American health care. Joining me now today from Orlando, Florida, is Donald Berwick, the pediatrician by training who until last Thursday was administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Medicare chief. He's former president and CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. For the moment, I guess, he's unemployed. Donald Berwick, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
In a nutshell, how do you describe why you are out of that job today instead of in it?
Absence of authentic dialogue, maybe, about what's needed and what's possible in American healthcare. Everything's been reduced to sound bites and rhetoric, and was really hard to engage, as I would have wanted to engage, with people who have some skepticism about the law and about what the possibilities are.
Given that you were in that role in part as a champion for President Obama's healthcare reforms, which Republicans have so adamantly rejected, do you think there was ever a chance that you might have been fully confirmed beyond the recess appointment to go the full term in that job?
Yeah, I mean, when I took the job, I knew the recess appointment had a limited time, but I was hopeful that maybe it would be possible to engage in some conversations about what's possible for American healthcare and really help produce the kind of improvements that I wanted. So I was hopeful. As the opposition mounted and the numbers went the wrong way, it became obvious that it wasn't going to last that long.
You've studied American healthcare all your life. You've practiced it as a pediatrician. Now you've really been in the belly of the beast for 17 months. Right in the middle of Medicare and Medicaid in the heart of Washington. I mean, this is a huge budget item, bigger than the Pentagon, as big as it gets. Many people fear that it could eat this country alive one day, and yet millions and millions of Americans depend on it. How have you come to see, Donald Berwick, the fundamental conflict, if there is one fundamental conflict, that we are somehow locked up in around health care in this country?
It's a sort of thrilling time in healthcare right now. The system's unfrozen. It doesn't perform very well. It's much too expensive, much more expensive than it needs to be, and major improvements are possible. So on the one hand, I think that we can buckle down as a country and actually get healthcare to perform the way we all want it to, with dignity and reliability, safety, and lower cost. The problem is that a lot of people don't understand that possibility. They don't realize how much better healthcare can get. And so the rhetoric seems to be all about cost cutting and taking things away from people, and people get frightened. I think we have to kind of cross the bridge from fear to optimism about what's really possible for the system. That's why that job was so fantastic. It was a chance to actually begin to advocate for and advance some of the changes that would make us all so much better off as patients and as citizens.
Keep spelunking with us here. Take us on down into these caves. I mean, if the rhetoric is about cost-cutting and fear of being cut off from services, but behind that rhetoric, there must be fundamentally different perspectives or interests at work here. And I'm trying to use your expertise and experience to take us closer to understanding what those are. What are the forces or the interests or the motivations that are arrayed against one another? Even if it's a promising time and that it's unfrozen right now, clearly it's also unresolved.
Yeah. Well, healthcare, I mean, it's $2.6 trillion. It's 17% of our economy. It's a big lump in the middle of our economy, and to make it better, it's going to have to change. We have to have a healthcare system that looks quite different from the one we have today, much more organized around needs of patients, much more oriented toward coordinated care for chronically ill people. So it can get better, but it has to change to get better. We have a system that we inherited, which is really organized around volume. Every different piece of the system makes money and thrives by doing its own thing best and more of it. And to change that from a healthcare system that's oriented toward value, so that what we're buying is health and continuity of experience and the best kind of care instead of the most care, that's a big change. And there are heavily invested economic interests in the status quo. So this is it's a dislocation of habits and investments that we're looking at. We need, for example, right now hospitals get rewarded for staying full. Mm-hmm. So you make more money as a hospital if the beds are full. But we know that people actually can be home. They don't have to be in the hospital. They don't have to bounce back with readmissions because they weren't properly dealt with when they were discharged,
right,
or get stay longer because they have a an infection after surgery. Infections after surgery can be vastly reduced. But remember, the hospital is making its money by having patients in beds. What we need is a healthcare system, in essence, where, say, hospitals make money by having people at home. That's a major change. That's going to require resorting the way we pay for, monitor, and improve care. There's also a knowledge gap. I don't think the public or a lot of the professions understand how much better things could be. They don't actually know how to eliminate infections, to reduce readmissions, to get really patient-centered. So we have an education task, too.
We want to look at how much better things could be. That vision is an important one right now for people to keep in their mind's eye. But talk to us for a second about how you describe these interests that are economic interests that are heavily invested in the status quo in Washington. In your 17 months there and in your time, you know, years before that, really focused on American healthcare, how do they put their finger on the scales? How do they influence the direction of healthcare, where it goes or where it doesn't go in this country? How's it work?
We have the Affordable Care Act now. It's this I call it
President Obama's reforms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've referred to the law as majestic. That's how it feels to me. The more I knew it, the more full of possibilities it seemed. But the act is organized around changes in care. For example, changing payment systems so that they're organized around buying value, as I said, rewarding hospitals, let's say paying a hospital more when infection rates fall than when they stay high.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the stakeholders push back on that. They say, wait a minute, are you measuring that exactly correctly? Is that really fair? Our patients are sicker. And you end up in this vast dialogue, unnecessary one if you ask me, about whether improvement really is possible. So it's people kind of defending the status quo, defending the system, saying it can't really be much better when actually it can be. And we have to get over that threshold. The law provides a very good foundation for doing that, by the way. We just have to stay at it.
So, but again, take us in. I mean, is it big hospital companies? Is it insurance companies? I mean, many people who wanted to see, let's say, universal coverage were disappointed at the role that insurance companies will continue to have in President Obama's reforms. Is it mainly hospital companies? Is it mainly individual doctors? X-ray the interest for us here.
It's everybody. In my office my schedule was full of people coming in saying we need more money. We need more to do what we do now. And the pushback is, wait a minute, why don't we do it differently? How about we cooperate? Why don't we work together as communities, combining the interests of hospitals and doctors? So they come in asking for more money, more funds to fund what they do right now.
That is volume, not value, too often.
Exactly. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about doctors or drug companies or hospitals. It's all about more instead of better. And that's a fundamental change of conversation.
How do we
do it?
Jess?
Go ahead. Well, they do it by calling their congressman and by, you know, a lot of the political pressures mount as people say, wait a minute, we don't really want, we're scared of this change, and that comes through as pressure.
If we stay on that path, volume, not value, you know, do more procedures, do more of this, do more of that, prescribe more drugs because volume makes a profit, where does it take us?
Over a cliff. The American healthcare economy is connected to America's overall economic well-being and to the global economy, and it is a vast part of our current problem of debt and deficit. It's also coming out of people's paychecks. You know, a lot of the people I met everyone's paying. In the end, all the money's coming from wages. You know, whether it's coming through taxes or out of pocket expenses, or what your employer is contributing to your insurance. So it's all our money. The rate of rise of those costs is phenomenal. It's way more than the growth of the gross domestic product. So healthcare eats into the economic well-being of America when it wastes money. It takes money away from schools and roads and museums and wages. And it's getting worse, not better. The Affordable Care Act is proposing a kind of turnaround there by helping to reorganize care. But the other thing that happens is equally grave. I mean, one of the things this law does is it takes a step toward universal coverage, takes a step toward justice in America, where healthcare becomes a human right, which it really needs to be. It does that by covering more people. 32 more million Americans are covered when that law is fully implemented. Well, we have to pay for that. We should pay for that, but we have to find that money. If we can't find the money, what happens is coverage goes down. Things are taken away from people. They will lose benefits, and of course that will affect the poor more than anyone else. We can't afford that as a country, and the way to do that, to get out of that box, is to improve care. And so the other part of the Affordable Care Act that orients us around reducing infections, reducing pressure ulcers, reducing complications, coordinating care for chronically ill, all of that is not just better for people, but it's where to find the money so we can afford justice and coverage.
Republican critics went after you because they said that they looked back through, combed through your record and found remarks that suggested, or at least in their interpretation, you tell us that this would require rationing. You looked at the British healthcare system and said, there's an example that we might follow. They quote you from a 2009 interview where you said, the decision is not whether or not we will ration care. The decision is whether we will ration with our eyes open. And they said, gotcha. You want that socialized medicine ration thing that we will never accept as Americans.
The gotcha is a soundbite, not a dialogue. Mm-hmm. I mean, that particular quote about rationing is taken completely out of context. What I was saying there is right now your insurance company rations. Look at your policy. It decides what you get and what you don't get. They'll tell you we'll cover this test but not that test. And that's all done in darkness. No one's accountable there. And I said, no, that should be done in daylight. If people are making decisions about what you have and don't have, let them be accountable for those decisions.
Eyes wide open. Donald Berwick, Dr. Donald Berwick, was chief of Medicare and Medicaid until last Thursday. He is out. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with healthcare reformer Dr. Donald Berwick, just out of Washington, and his position as chief of Medicare and Medicaid, covering one out of every three Americans. He wanted change, better quality, lower cost. Republicans did not want him. His perspective, his championing of President Obama's healthcare reforms, he was supposed to be the champion for that system. Now he's out as of last week. He joins us today. Back in the summer of 2010, President Obama used a recess appointment to put Donald Berwick, pediatrician, lifelong practitioner, and reformer of health care, in at the top of Medicare and Medicaid. Here was Republican Senator John Barroso of Wyoming on July of that year on the Senate floor.
You say, do I really want Dr. Berwick? Do I want somebody who is in love with the National Health Service of Britain? Someone who says they have incredible respect for the way it works and thinks it's the right way to go? Why would an American citizen want that person to be in charge of Medicare and Medicaid for this country?
Do you want to go the way of British health care? The question on the floor of the Senate. Donald Berwick joins us today from Orlando, Florida. He's just a couple of days out of that position at the top of the biggest line item in the American budget, bigger than the Pentagon. Donald Berwick, how about it? I mean, you've been knighted by Queen Elizabeth for, you know, your advising on reforms to England's National Health Service. You have spoken very admiringly of it. What about that model and the American challenge? How do you see the interplay?
Every country is going to need to find its own way to a better healthcare system, and most are trying. I don't think you can import one model from one country into another. We've chosen in the United States a mixed model, one that's going to have part public financing, part private. It's going to have privately run healthcare, not generally governmentally run healthcare. That's our choice. We can make that work just fine. What Senator Barroso was quoting, and by the way, I never exchanged a word with him. He never asked me what I thought. Is that the British health system at the time I was giving that speech, which was the 60th anniversary, it has universal coverage. You can't wake up in the morning in Great Britain and wonder if your health insurance is going to be taken away. It can't be taken away. You have it as a matter of right. We didn't have that in this country. Now we do. We're taking a big step toward the Affordable Care Act. I was praising them for universal coverage. They had brought me there because they have problems. And so just like in the U.S., we had, were problems in Britain and waiting times and reliability, and they were working quite hard to improve it. But we have our own solution here, and it can work fine if we stick with it. We are on track if we just keep at it now.
Republicans just pounded on you for that advising and the elements of admiration that you had for the British system. Again, in July 2010, here's Senator John Kyle, Republican, Arizona.
His views are antithetical to the views of the majority of the American people, supporting rationing as he does. His love affair with the British single-payer system, as he has described it. This is not something that the American people would have countenanced. So Barack Obama, the president, rather than filling the position, decided to hold off on nominating a person to head CMS until after the health care debate was over with.
Antithetical, Donald Berwick's views, to the views of the majority of the American people. So says Senator Berwick. Donald Berwick, when you were in the UK for that 60th anniversary of England's National Health Service, and you gave a speech there talking about it, saying it was far from perfect, the British system, but you also said you praised its kind of fundamental premise, and you said any healthcare funding plan that is just, equitable, civilized, and humane must redistribute wealth from the richer among us to the poorer and less fortunate. Excellent health care, you said, is by definition redistribution. Britain, you chose well. Put that in an American context for us, Donald Berwick. You said earlier, you know, we're headed over a cliff, but we've got to find money for the coverage that is just in this country. Does that mean redistribution? Or what portion is redistribution? What portion is reform of how we do it? Go there.
Well, insurance is redistribution. It is simply a fact that illness and poverty go together. Wealth and health are inversely related. So if we are a country in which we want to make sure that if you become ill, you get care, then we're saying those of us who have more because we're healthier are going to help those of us who have less because we're not healthy. It's just and of course, there we will all go there someday. All of us will face illnesses. And at that point, we're going to need the help of others. That's really the moral question for the country. Do we help each other with our health? And if the concept that that's redistributional, that's just a fact. That means that when I'm in trouble, I can count on you to help me. And when you're in trouble, you can count on me to help you. That's what this is about. When we have programs like Medicare and Medicaid, they're guarantees. They mean that Americans can be promised that they're going to have access to health care no matter what their status or condition. I think that's what our country needs to have.
I wonder how you read – you heard Senator Kyle's interpretation of American public opinion on that. I wonder how you read it. I mean, there was this moment. I'm sure you saw it. This was in September at a Tea Party Republican presidential debate. This was in Florida. And CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked Ron Paul – what he would do if a healthy 30-year-old man who opted out of health care insurance had a terrible accident, went into a coma. Listen to the crowd in the background.
My advice to him would have a major medical policy, but not before.
But he doesn't have that. He doesn't have it, and he needs intensive care for 6 months. Who pays?
That's what freedom is all about, taking your own risk. This whole idea that you have to prepare and take care of everybody.
But, Congressman, are you saying that society should just let him die?
No.
Let him die? Yeah. Okay. There's the audience, and I wonder what you thought of that, Donald Berwick. But also, what about Ron Paul saying, you know, that's what freedom is all about, taking your own risk. And he sort of disses there, you heard him begin, the whole idea that you have to prepare to take care of everybody. What about that perspective?
I mean, maybe I sense a different America. I think we're a country where we can help each other, and we rely on that. We want to do that. And I think that's where the public is. Recent polls showing public support for Medicaid, for example, a very important program that really helps people when they're in the most serious forms of trouble, shows enormous public support for Medicaid, as it should. I think we're a generous and caring country, and we need to translate that into the way we behave in healthcare. And in general, we do. I think Senator Kyle was wrong. I think he's out of touch with Americans. I think Americans want a healthcare system that's just, reliable, available, and available to all. That's what I've sensed. I've been out and around the country. I traveled to every region, as many states as I could get to, and every time I was with a group of people. And once they understood what the Affordable Care Act does, they were there. I mean, they said, yep, that's what we want, a just healthcare system where people can get what they need and we'll help each other.
Can we have that just, available, and affordable?
If we improve it, that's the other part of this. The Affordable Care Act, the new law, it's kind of like two laws in one. One law is this coverage law. It's the justice law, if you take my word. It means
extending to more people, millions more people.
Millions, yeah. If you're in America, you can get health care. That's a moral commitment. The other part of the law is the improvement law, and that's what I think the public doesn't quite understand enough yet, and maybe the professions don't, how much better it can be. And in healthcare, like in every other part of the economy, when quality improves, costs fall. You know that. You know that when you buy a car and it's a lemon, that's going to cost you more than if it really works right. You know that if the computer you buy today is so much, has many more functions than it did 5 or 6 years ago, and it's cheaper, certainly cheaper per function. And that's because constant improvement, innovation, is a route to making things better and less expensive, and that is exactly true of healthcare. It's very, very expensive. when a patient gets an infection in a hospital that could have been avoided. It's very, very expensive when Mrs. Jones, who has congestive heart failure, goes home from the hospital and nobody helps her understand her meds and she gets worse and nobody notices and she bounces back into the hospital. That's more expensive than if she gets to stay home where she really wants to be and healthy, which is what she wants to be.
You looked early on in your career at Edward Deming, the American father of quality control at Toyota, and how they put, constant improvement into their system of making automobiles. If we were to apply that to the American healthcare system today, I mean, how much better could it be, both in terms of outcomes and in terms of cost? How far short of achievable optimum are we falling?
We're way far short, but there's a lot of promise here. Yes, I was a student of how other industries improved products and services, and those improvements are – you have to do that now to be globally competitive in manufacturing and in many service industries. Healthcare remained outside that progress, largely because it was built in such a fragmented way, and we never really saw healthcare as the system that it is. But those that are realizing that, are starting to do that, their results are astounding. The National Quality Award, the Baldrige Prize, was awarded last week to several American healthcare organizations. For example, the South Central Foundation in Anchorage, Alaska, which is doing an amazing project called NUCA, which is organizing coordinated care for very challenged patients. They're reducing costs right and left. A 50% reduction in emergency room visits, reduction in reliance on expensive tests and specialties, and much better outcomes for patients. Denver Health, a really stunning place in Denver, Colorado, they've saved $100 million in the past few years by adopting Toyota production methods, the lean production in their own work. Patients are better off, staff are happier, and costs have fallen by $100 million. We can do that everywhere.
What would it mean for profits in the American healthcare industry? Could they be as big as they have historically been in this country? Or would it necessarily mean that the interests that you described here would have to take a hit?
They have to make a change. We're a clever country. I'm quite sure that healthcare as a business can discover how to make money in a new environment of coordinated, reliable, safe care once they get over the transitions. So I think people can actually thrive in that world of coordinated care, but they do have to face changes, and some things get smaller.
Can they make money on the scale that they're accustomed to, in order to support the lifestyles that are now depend on the current system?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, hospital profit margins, for example, are very low, in the order of 1 or 2% if they're lucky. So profits aren't a big part of the cost structure of hospitals. But the problem now is a hospital makes its money by volume, by increasing its revenues. What if we suggested that a hospital's profits should depend more on how well the patients do, on what the outcomes are, whether they get to stay home and well? Well, that 1 or 2% is actually rather inexpensive. If we could get the payment system right, the profits would be there. No industry that makes profits on waste is a durable one. And so changing healthcare's business interests to align more with patient well-being, that's the secret here. And yes, there's no question that entrepreneurs can thrive in that environment.
Dr. Donald Berwick is with us until last Thursday. He was chief of Medicare and Medicaid in this country, a budget bigger than the Pentagon's huge throw weight in the American healthcare system. He was not confirmed into that position beyond his recess appointment. Republicans objected. He's out. He's with us today. You're welcome to put your questions to him. John in Lexington, Kentucky, you're on the air with Donald Berwick.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Enjoy your program.
Thank you.
The question for your guest, in my mind, we can't afford the programs we have today, Medicaid, Medicare. How do we fund health care reform? And with that, I'll hang up and listen to the response.
It's on the table, health care reform, President Obama's reform. How do we fund it? Don.
By the way, John, thanks for your question. It's not just a Medicare and Medicaid problem. There are stakeholders in the whole healthcare system. So if you were an employer or a labor union, you might be asking the same question: how can we afford the reform? My answer is improvement. We can afford it by taking the waste out of the care, the waste that hurts patients, it hurts families, it hurts communities. For example, we don't do very well with chronic care at all. There are 9 million people in our country that have both Medicare and Medicaid. They're called dual eligibles. That's because they have many chronic illnesses, they're very challenged, and they don't have high incomes. They cost our country about $300 or $320 billion of care. Easily a third of that is just waste because they get complications in their care that could be avoided if we get them into coordinated systems of care that actually meet their needs far better. So the answer, John, is we afford coverage by improving care. And if the public can come to understand that, we're on track. We can have the healthcare system we want and we need available to absolutely everybody.
Do you have to take something away from people who today feel well covered, whether they've read the fine print of their policy or not? Do you have to take something away from those people?
I don't think so. This is a really interesting case where everybody wins. If we stick with the Affordable Care Act and move toward the kind of care system I know we can have, almost everybody wins. I mean, yeah, today you might have health care coverage, but tomorrow it could be taken away from you. If you change jobs without the Affordable Care Act and you happen to have diabetes, well, then the insurance company can say, I'm sorry, you have a pre-existing condition, so you can't have coverage. So you may feel secure now, but you're not that secure unless we stick with this reform of the health care system. And by the way, in the Affordable Care Act, people with coverage are far better off. In Medicare, you know, a lot of seniors face the so-called donut hole where their
pharmaceutical
pharmaceutical coverage goes away after they spent something like $2,800 or $2,900. It goes away for a period of time. That's terrible. I met seniors out there who, I mean, they were really upset. They said, I can't afford my meds. It's meds or food. Mm-hmm. And now we have a law which allows us to say, oh, now you can. We're helping you. We're taking responsibility for that. Prevention is now coverage. When Medicare was founded in the 60s, it didn't cover prevention. It was acute care programs, and a few prevention benefits have been added. But now with the Affordable Care Act, first dollar coverage for any preventive practices that are certified as effective by the Preventive Services Task Force. I mean, that's a gain for everybody. This is a law. This is a win-win law for so many of us.
Prevent and pay less is the idea. David in Bedford, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Donald Berwick. Your question, David?
Hi, Tom and Dr. Berwick. I hope you're doing great today. Well, what a great topic, and I think it's the most important topic I've heard on your show in so long. It's, I think healthcare, the cost of healthcare is really killing us. I admire Dr. Berwick for putting up with the vitriol, but you know, unfortunately, the victim of it at this point. But I think the failure to communicate to the average American what's going on and what the real solutions are. Is costing us. I was actually a proponent of the one-payer system. I believed that was going to bring the cost down, but that got shot down to socialism immediately, and it was too fearful a topic to ever come up again. I think that, you know, in my mind, I'll wrap this up with a statement, and then I guess a question that you can answer when I hang up, but it costs me, I have a family of four, $18,000 a year. I'm self-employed in a small restaurant in Bedford, and that's a lot of money, and I'm no different than everybody else that's self-employed. We've got to put out $18,000 to insure our families. That's a salary. Yeah. That's an entry-level salary.
Yes.
And when I voted for Obama, I was expecting to see healthcare costs come down. Instead, they've gone up, and I don't see them coming down at all. And I wonder what this Affordable Care Act, I don't see it as affordable. I just see my own personal out-of-pocket expenses going up dramatically forever.
David, we're right up against the break here, but Donald Berwick, take a first whack at that. We'll come back to it. He voted for Obama, hoped they'd come down. He's paying $18,000 a year.
The Affordable Care Act's an answer to that problem, David, not the problem. If we stick with it, costs will fall. And maybe after the break, Tom, if you want to ask me, I can explain how.
We'll come back and look at that with Dr. Donald Berwick. What perspective do we need to fix our healthcare mess? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking this hour with healthcare reformer Dr. Donald Berwick. We've got a lot of response online here. We'll look at some of that. Mike says, Donald Berwick for president. Not everybody's so enthused. But what about the question of cost? And our caller who says, you know, he's a small business owner, family of four, healthcare costs him $18,000 a year, and it's gone up, not down, while President Obama has been president. He's disgruntled with that, and you began to respond, Dr. Berwick.
Yeah, well, David, the small business owner, is exactly right. The costs are unacceptable. I visited with a friend a couple of weeks ago who said that he's a small businessman. He's now paying in healthcare premiums for his employees what he used to pay in wages less than 10 years ago. So we are headed for a cliff, and David's business is in trouble if we can't fix that. I understand that. But the cause is not the Affordable Care Act. The cause is the structural problems in American healthcare itself, the way we built a fragmented system. Remember, Americans are spending twice as much for healthcare per capita as in any other country, or nearly that. You can debate whether we have the best healthcare in the world. We do in some ways and not others, but we're not twice as good. So there's a lot of margin there. The Affordable Care Act is offering the country a set of components, remedies to that problem, they're a little hard to understand. And I think David's comment about communication is absolutely right. The story needs to be better understood, but it's not so complicated.
So how and when does cheaper health care kick in for David and his $18,000 bill?
As fast as possible is what I say. We have programs now coming forward under the Affordable Care Act first that should in the next several years begin to see some gains, at least where the communities pick up the idea. For example, accountable care organizations. This is it's a new way to pay for health care for Medicare beneficiaries in which primary care centers get rewarded for taking care of the whole patient. And if they keep the patient out of the hospital, they make more money. That's a very important change in payment, and it should result in better care and lower costs.
That's if you're covered by Medicare. What about – here's David. He's working. He's not covered by Medicare. How does it ever come to him?
The really neat thing is that we're all in this together, and as CMS administrator, I could sense this opportunity for partnership because on the private side, employers, consumer groups, professional groups, and insurers, they have the same problem and they have some of the same solutions. And we're really at this wonderful point in the country of perhaps coming together both on the public and the private pay side and say we all want the same thing. We want seamless care. We want safe care. We want patient-centered care. And we want care that doesn't waste a nickel of our money. And so we're aligning that metrics, payment methods is now really, really possible. That was – by the way, David, you know, expressed sympathy for me. I need no sympathy. It was an absolutely wonderful job, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And it's because of this sense of possibility. Now we need to bring the optimism into the country that really we can do this, and believe me, we can.
Well, Medicare and Medicaid can have a huge influence on what happens here. I mean, they're so gigantic. They have plenty of problems. We'll look at them. But if they succeed in getting behind reforms, those reforms are by definition widespread. Is your successor in this post going to push for that? It's Marilyn Tavener. She was your principal deputy there. But it's interesting. She's also got very strong support from Republicans. Eric Cantor, House Majority Leader, you know, saying, you know, she's going to do a great job, with a system that based on the private sector. Are you confident that the reforms you began to implement in Medicare are going to go forward in your absence?
Yes, for sure. Marilyn's terrific. Well, because it's not me. This isn't about me. This is about a time in our nation. And there are forces all over the country now, progressive leaders in the professions, enlightened hospital leadership, certainly payers, both unions and employers. They all know this is – the time has come. They're all David, and they understand the change is needed. The country's fortunate to have Marilyn Tavener services now. She is a – very, very capable, very experienced person, both on political side. She's a nurse by training. She was a critical care nurse. She has everything it takes to keep this going. And frankly, I don't think it's stoppable now. I think I'd love to talk to David in a few years because I think we're going to look back and say, wow, we're glad we got through that.
Donald Berwick, I hear you sound very reasonable on many fronts, but the description you just gave of the American, national posture on healthcare is a little bewildering. I mean, there is a wall of fierce opposition to the Obama healthcare reforms. You've got Republican candidates practically using that as the cornerstone of their opposition, their effort to, you know, kick President Obama out of the White House. How can you say that we're all in this together now?
The people that give care are in this together. We understand that we do need to change. I'm here at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement National Meeting, and I wish you were all here. There are 6,000 people here, 14,000 on satellite, and they're oriented to change. I think this is all about the patient, and I think people are going to know, and if we are careful to tell the story accurately, they're going to know even more how much better off they are in the healthcare that we can build in the future. Think of it the other way. If we take the Affordable Care Act away, look at what happens already. People are going to – seniors who can't afford drugs now are going to have it all back on their backs again. The extra drug coverage that's available will go away. Preventive coverage is going to go away now. Kids under 26 covered under their parents' policies, they're going to lose that coverage. The promise of insurance companies on better behavior because they can't take away your health care coverage if you have a pre-existing condition. All of that is now in process. So I think people are going to begin to really realize how much they're going to lose if we try to go back. So I don't think we're going to go back. I think we're going to go forward.
Huge issues around American healthcare, and they go right to people's fundamental health and pocketbooks. Montgomery, Alabama, John is calling. John, you're on the air with Donald Berwick.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm under the belief that when the federal government gets involved with things like healthcare, like what y'all have been talking about this morning or this afternoon, whoever's listening, one thing is guaranteed that, and I've heard Dr. Donald, I believe his name is.
Berwick, yes.
Talk about, is it Dr. Berwick? I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how the costs will be better. But I look to the housing and the education as an indicator of what happens when the government gets involved, which is the one guarantee that I see from Obamacare, or the Health Act is what they're calling it, is that costs will go up and quality will go down. And and one more thing is that I think those, I am one of the people who obviously is opposed to this bill, but one of the things that's misunderstood about those people, and I'm not a Republican, I don't consider myself a Republican, y'all have talked about how Republicans are against this. I'm an American who's self-insured, who believes in liberty, and for those who criticize people who believe in free markets and believe in liberty as not being compassionate about, you know, the example with the guy who's uninsured who dies on the road.
Yep.
To confuse that with being incompassionate is, I think, a misunderstanding. And one last point that I want to make. When the doctor talks about how a lot of Americans don't understand these things, I consider myself to be one of those people who, you know, doesn't understand these things. Well, I would say that a lot of politicians and a lot of legislatures don't understand liberty.
John, let us pick it up right there. You've put a lot on the table. Donald Berwick, here's a liberty-loving caller. Who, as I take it, his bottom line is privatize. Don't go the other way. You get government in, that means costs up, quality down. He just doesn't buy the formula that I think John in Montgomery hears you laying out. How do you respond?
Yeah, thanks, John. I mean, you're raising some really important, very deep issues about what kind of country we are. I'm a doctor. I'm trained to be a doctor. When a patient comes in to see me or came in to see me, my whole instinct is to help them. That's why I'm there. And that's the kind of country I envision, where people in trouble get some help. And yes, so that they can get back to their responsibilities as citizens. And I don't know if we disagree about that, but I think we should help each other. And I don't think that has to do with liberty. That has to do with, that does have to do with compassion. The question as to what the role of the federal government is, we probably agree more than you think, John. I mean, I can see both the strengths and the limits of the federal government. We need law, for example, to keep insurance companies on proper behavior, or they will take away coverage from people who are sick. That's how the game is played. We can't allow that, and that's, I think the federal government has a very important role there, and that's what the Affordable Care Act does. Federal government can support innovations. There's an innovation center in this law which allows you, John, people in your state or your region to come up with great ideas and get some support so that they can explore those ideas and see if they're worth spreading. But the thing you and I fundamentally agree about is this is all in the end going to happen in communities and local settings. The federal government can set a kind of context in place, but the innovations that are needed in Alabama, in rural Alabama, are going to look different from the ones needed in inner city New York, and they're going to be different from the ones needed in Portland, Oregon. And we need to foster this kind of customization of care systems to local settings, and I'm totally for that.
I'm not absolutely sure. I mean, you use the word community, our caller, and thanks for your call, John. John uses the word liberty above all. I mean, you can hear behind that this kind of fear that is out there of being buried alive in some sort of rationed healthcare world where you can't get back to taking care of yourself on your own terms. What about that concern, that fear?
There is a lot of fear. Back to my message about improvement. If we improve care, we all get better off, and we have to really stay with that idea. John, for his interest in liberty, which I completely respect, is himself not at liberty. As he seeks insurance, his ability to find that insurance is controlled by forces he has no control over, and it's not the federal government. Federal government is at his side here. It's trying to allow him to pursue the health care he wants, setting conditions in place for him to be able to find that. I think he's overstating in this case his amount of leverage. I want him to be able to have exactly the care he wants and needs, and we need to set up a health care system which allows for that.
John, thanks for your call. Beverly in Newton, Massachusetts. Beverly, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a physician. Hi, Don. We've met before. I work in patient safety and quality improvement and have for the past decade in the Boston healthcare market. And I just want to say that, you know, I think the failure to confirm Don as the head of CMS is really a microcosm of what's wrong with Washington. It's judging a very capable individual who has done a tremendous amount through the IHI, through his Million Lives campaign, through patient-centered medical homes, through accountable care organizations, to really put forward quality and improvement in healthcare. And politicians have just taken sound bites completely out of context in past judgment on Don's work.
So do you share his confidence, Beverly, that we're headed toward a kind of big solution here because it's obvious to everybody that we need it?
I do, because that's what I am working with on a day-to-day basis. I mean, that's the work that I'm involved in. And that's the work. I'm an OBGYN by training, and I've completely changed my focus to quality improvement and, you know, healthcare improvement. So, yes, I do believe in it. And I just wanted to, you know, I think there have been many organizations that have proven that there's 30% waste in our healthcare system, but I just have a personal story I'd like to tell. My father was admitted to an ICU a couple months ago. He was admitted to a hospital. With a very bad respiratory infection. He also has other conditions for which he takes pain medicine. They over-medicated him. He became disoriented, change in his mental status. They actually made arrangements to transfer him to the ICU because they thought he was having a stroke, but just on the off chance, they treated him with a medication to counteract the pain medicine.
Okay.
He woke up. He was fine, but the doctor who had already made the decision to transfer him to the ICU went ahead and transferred him. He could not explain that to me as a family member and as a physician with anything other than, well, I already wrote the order.
And you're saying that would be damaging for his health, or that would be costly for him to go on to the intensive care?
It was costly in the tens of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who's been in an ICU knows that that is not the place for people who are not sick enough to be there to get better.
And you're a doctor, and you saw that as unnecessary. That means cost and doesn't necessarily mean health. Our time is short. Beverly, I appreciate your call. Can we design a system, Donald Berwick, that irons out all the, you know, billion wrinkles like that in our system and ends up bringing us savings in health and cash that put us on a better track?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, yes. If we understand that as a country and commit to it, things can get better and less expensive to everyone's benefit. Beverly mentioned over-medication. That's something I got interested in right at the end of my tenure there. We have a very interesting report from the Inspector General showing vast use of antipsychotics, over-medication of patients in nursing homes. That means they go into coma, they get pressure ulcers, they aspirate, they get worse. And it's just bad use of medicines. I called together the leaders of the nursing home industry and geriatricians and pharmacists in my office just a couple months ago, and I said, why don't we stop it? Let's stop this. Let's figure out how to keep from over-medicating people who are very vulnerable. I said, can I hear from you each in 2 weeks about your plan for doing that? 2 weeks later, I had a stack of letters, a plan underway. There's now momentum all over the country for reduction of this unnecessary use of sedation, which leads to complications, higher cost, and lower quality. Yeah, we can do this.
You're out. President Obama could be out as of next fall. There's a re-election campaign that's mounting up now, a lot of challengers. If it's a Republican president next in the White House, given the fierce opposition to the reforms that you praise, in that instance, where do you see American healthcare going?
Well, first, I dearly hope this president gets reelected. He's a great leader, and we, thanks to him, we have in our hands a piece of policy, the Affordable Care Act, that's very, very hopeful for our country. So that's what I hope. And it doesn't matter who's president, though. They're going to face the same problem. They're going to be facing an American healthcare system that costs far too much and does far too little for patients. And they're now going to find themselves in the company of doctors and nurses and hospital leaders and pharmacists and patients' rights groups and payers who all think the same thing. So I don't think they can stop it. I think they're going to have to lead it.
And if we turn toward privatization rather than the Obama reforms, do you see a potential solution there?
That's a false dichotomy. The Obama reforms are not – they're not privatization. They rely very, very heavily. They keep a private insurance industry. It doesn't change the way healthcare delivery is owned or managed. It's not government-run healthcare. That's silly. It's the same system we have but organized now around the needs of patients.
Donald Berwick, Dr. Donald Berwick, administrator until last Thursday of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Medicare chief, providing health care for 100 million Americans. We'll be interested to see where your path takes you next, but we're grateful to you for being with us just out of that seat to be with us today. Don Berwick, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.